PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the PD Podscast, episode 23, with myself, Pranay Budev, a pediatric orthopedic surgeon from England. Firstly, I'd like to thank all of our listeners for getting us across the 10,500 downloads milestone, in addition for us being nominated for the BOTA Web Awards for Best Podcast. I continue to hope you enjoy our content. Please share, like, and subscribe to our podcast, and share your thoughts on social media, including Instagram and Twitter. Our next episode was recorded just prior to the COVID pandemic during my trip to Toronto, Canada. I had the pleasure of sitting with Professor James Wright, who is a professor at the University of Toronto and a pediatric orthopedic surgeon and scientist, very well known for his advancement of evidence-based orthopedics and for his national leadership in improving access to children's surgery. He served at the Hospital of Sick Children for a number of years and now works at the Ontario Medical Association as the Chief of Health Policy, Economics and Research. He's extremely well published with over 300 articles and 20,000 plus citation, supervised over 30 MSc and PhD students, and also spent some time at the University of Oxford as a Senior Clinical Research Fellow and Professor of Orthopedics. He has been awarded with numerous accolades, including the Robert Salter Excellence in Orthopedic Education, Arthur H. Ware Memorial Award from POSNA, and the Kappa Delta Award from AOS, in addition to receiving the Order of Canada in 2016 for his advances in the field of pediatric orthopedics and identifying optimal treatment. I had a fantastic discussion with him with regards to his career, his interest, and how he developed a legacy in the field of evidence-based orthopedics, and how he continues to serve in a different role today. I hope you enjoy the episode. Let's get into it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sitting on the ninth floor of Bloor Street West in the downtown Toronto at the Ontario Medical Association with Professor James Wright. I'm very, very grateful for you giving me this time to talk about your long, illustrious career. So can you essentially introduce yourself to the audience and tell us how your medical career started and developed?
Right. So I'm a children's orthopedic surgeon. I was a children's foot and ankle surgeon in my clinical practice. I have done a variety of things, both clinically, administratively, research, and now my interest is in transforming healthcare through my role at the Ontario Medical Association.
And you initially started your career at the University of Toronto, and you ended up going to Yale, and you were telling me something briefly about that. So
right. So obviously, I was interested in academics, making impact not just through my clinical care, but through research. Basic science seemed too distant from the care of patients. So when I was a resident, I had some experience doing basic research, and it was interesting, it was fascinating, but it really didn't seem to have relevance to what had initially attracted me to medicine, which was looking after patients. So clinical epidemiology was very much at the early stages, and an opportunity came available, something called the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program. And so I applied and I was accepted. The head of the program there was an internist named Alvin Feinstein, who actually coined the term clinical epidemiology, was in many people's eyes was the father of clinical epidemiology. He was a general internist, and that's where I spent 2 years, and I got my master's of public health. The key was to get formal research training rather than just have an interest. So that was the aim.
And then you came, where did you do your residency and sort of fellowships in pediatric orthopedics?
So I did my residency in Toronto. I had been in general practice in Northern Canada, and so I came back to Toronto for 5 years. I did a fellowship with Mercer Rang and John Wedge at SickKids. Then I went to the Royal Children's in Melbourne. And then I went to New Haven, where I did my graduate degree for 2 years. So,
and any particular stories from your fellowship days at any of those institutions?
At the Royal Children's, I worked with Bill Cole and Malcolm Menelaus, two wonderful Australians. Malcolm, who's now has died. He was a very tall, gangly, humorous guy. He saw humor in just about everything, and he looked after spina bifida, which was also a big part of my clinical practice, mainly because I didn't understand it at all when I was a resident or a fellow, and I thought that would be a good thing to learn about. In Toronto, I worked with Mercer Rang, Bob Salter. Bob was a colorful figure, and Mercer, known worldwide in everything he did as a also humorous. So I got to work with fine orthopedic surgeons. That was a nice part.
And you were also an ABC fellow, I believe.
So I was,
where did you travel on that experience?
So that was South Africa for a month, and then the UK for 3 weeks. So it was 7 weeks away, which I've said was way too much of a good thing. Being away for 7 weeks, 49 days to be exact, was too much. But I got to meet an enormous number of people. And traveling to South Africa was a fascinating experience. And I was engaged totally in the UK, so that's why I was very happy to work there for 2.5 years, ultimately, but much later on in my career.
And one of your proteges and one of our previous guests, Dan Perry, is going to be the ABC Fellow this year, as I'm sure you know. You were appointed at SickKids. You were there for a long period of time, I think 24 years or so. Tell us, what did your clinical practice entail, and how your position developed? Because you took on a lot of leadership roles as well.
So my clinical practice was foot and ankle surgery. It started somewhat fortuitously. So Peter Armstrong, who was a colleague for a very brief period of time, he left to go to the US, and he had a very large club foot practice. And so I kind of walked into that. And at the time, club foot was managed through extensive surgery. So it was the commonest. I did hundreds of club foot releases. And that naturally developed become pediatric foot and ankle surgery, which really is still an underdeveloped aspect of pediatric orthopedics. And because I did a lot of research in order to maintain, in my view, clinical legitimacy, but also to have the best outcomes, I needed to specialize. So I became a foot and ankle surgeon, and that became pretty much my entire practice, other than looking after the care of children with spina bifida, who also have a huge number of foot problems. So that became what I did. And that was a very satisfying part of my career.
And did you end up seeing a lot of sort of normal variant type conditions as well? And then tell me about some of the more interesting reconstructive surgeries, like with arthrogryposis and problems such like that.
Right. So SickKids has a unique position. It's a dominant children's hospital in Canada and certainly in Ontario. And we have different pressures, so we don't work fee for service at SickKids. So in some contexts, there is a need to look after all the normal variants because they are remunerative, and they bring in all the cases you might bring. So if I look at my colleagues in the U.S., they have a need to manage the full spectrum. But SickKids, we were able to focus ourselves on the high end. Children, meaning the most complex. And I would say 80% of the children I operate on were all complex. So I didn't have in fact, I would often wish for a slightly routine case just because it was so intense. So the children with spina bifida have terrible problems with their feet. That change with time because of the neurologic picture. I looked after the kids with Charcot-Marie tooth. So these are changing, evolving foot deformities that you try and intercede at the appropriate time, not to go too late in the course because it became more difficult to get the foot to do what you wanted to do, but not too early because then you would see recurrences. So it was a, and there's some very talented people now looking after that practice at SickKids, which I'm very happy because that's a big part of pediatric orthopedics.
And over your career, I'm sure the approach to managing some of these complex conditions changed. What would you say in your time there was the biggest change in the way you managed foot conditions with regards to surgically?
I think we learned from the adult foot and ankle surgeons, and I think the adult foot and ankle surgeons learned from us. I eschewed arthrodesis. I really tried to avoid fusing a foot, so a huge amount of periarticular procedures trying to preserve as much motion. Also the idea that I would often or I would say to the fellows, you're not doing a foot operation, you're usually doing 2, 3, 5, or 7 operations, you're just doing them all at the same time. I think the biggest thing that I was pleased to see, but also was the biggest frustration for me, was pain management. Foot surgery turns out to be horribly painful, and when it works well, it was fabulous to be able to look after these children and see that they weren't in pain. When it didn't go well, it was heartbreaking to see how painful surgery could be.
And that sort of takes us nicely onto your role within the research community, because as a scientific researcher, you're really known for the advancement of evidence-based medicine. And you know, you did this clinical epidemiology training, and was, as you said, probably the first orthopedic surgeon to do so. Tell me why you feel evidence-based medicine was really the way to go, and why you've made it really a focus of your career.
So as we look in the field of orthopedics, case series, that is uncontrolled research, has made some huge advances. And perfect example in pediatric orthopedics is Ponseti management of clubfoot. You didn't need a randomized controlled trial to know that that was the best way to treat clubfoot. But if you look at most of those major advances, John Charnley, 1972, total hip replacement, Paul Harrington, instrumentation of the spine, the AO group, those are 30, 40, 50 years old. And if you look now at case series, all you're seeing is more options. You're not seeing what's the best option. And that kind of variability in practice, the uncertainty, what's the best treatment, we needed a better way. We needed some other way to sort through the clinical dilemmas, which were really unresolved from my residency, my fellowship, my time as a children's orthopedic surgeon. And the route forward, albeit with its pros and cons, is evidence-based medicine. And frequently that's randomized clinical trials, but it doesn't have to be. It can be prospective, well-performed studies, but we need to do better studies to understand the questions that confront patients, families, and children's orthopedic surgeons.
And how did you start out running these trials? How were they funded? And was there any resistance from colleagues about doing these sorts of studies?
Absolutely. So it had to be peer-reviewed funding. We came up with some models, which we've called the small, simple trial, trying to simplify it as much as possible, reducing the cost and the complexity. Most orthopedic surgeons were unfamiliar with clinical trials and what was involved. So that was a challenge, because they needed to be brought up to speed, and there need to be local infrastructure. I went to funding agencies. I cobbled together money wherever I could to do clinical trials. And some of them have had a big impact on children's orthopedics. And I've still got one ongoing now, which I hope will end up with a useful answer.
And which one is that?
It's looking at the use of a bone-forming substance in simple bone cysts. Simple bone cysts is a wonderful model. Because there's so much variability in how it's treated. And we hope to look and see whether a bone enhancing substitute actually makes a difference. There's some evidence to believe that it may actually impede healing. And given the frequency that it's used and the cost, we think this is an important trial. So that's 26 sites in 3 continents, including the UK, and we're quite excited. We're about 2/3 of the way through patient recruitment.
Fantastic. And another place where you've had a big impact has really been on developing outcome measures, because mm-hmm. that was never really done. You know, we collect PROMs for patients who've had hip replacements, knee replacements, but not really in children, because it's very difficult to do it at certain ages. And then also you have the parents sort of involvement in that. How did you sort of start out in there? What outcome measures have you developed in your career that you can tell me about?
So as we were beginning to tackle these clinical questions, we had to come up with a meaningful outcome. And there were some very frequently used outcomes which had been surgeon-derived, and really smart clinicians who kind of got a sense, whether it be the Harris Hip Score or the Hospital for Special Surgery Knee Score, these were really important advances. The difficulty were that they weren't really based on what patients thought was important, and they also mixed together a range of motion and functional outcomes and radiographic outcomes. So they really were a mixture of outcomes. So this was called the outcomes movement, and it was the late 80s, early 90s. And the idea was, is we need to understand what patients think are important, because most of the time in orthopedics, that's what we're doing. We're either restoring function or we're leaving disability and pain. So that became a major focus. I was involved in the development of the DASH score, the Toronto Extremity Surgical Salvage Score, scores for spina bifida spine, muscular dystrophy spine. We developed some patient-specific measures for patients undergoing hip and knee replacements. So probably for the first 5 to 7 years of my research career, it was largely developed on measurement, because until we had that, you can't really do a clinical trial until you've got a measure, and until you have a, until you've decided what's most important, you can't get to that stage. So that's why it was a big focus early on.
And your reach has obviously been a lot more than the scores you've developed, because you've been really a true inspiration and mentor to people like Dan Perry and Uni, who have since further gone and done things like the CP Child, which has now revolutionized the way we collect scoring.
To have a small part in and it is a very small part in people of such talent like Uni and Dan, and that's one of the great parts about an academic place, particularly SickKids. We have one of the largest fellowship programs in the world, so I would have had the privilege of being associated with 125 fellows in my time there.
Yeah, we recently recorded an episode with the current fellowship director there, and learned all about their program. Tell me, in addition, you also concentrated very much on trying to meet the needs of patients who did not have access to surgical therapy. Mm. How did you even get into that? Why did you feel it was important, and what steps did you take to actually change it?
So I started out my career largely focused on research, believing that that was the impact I could have. And I became very involved ultimately in professional associations, the American Academy and Pediatric Orthopedic Society of North America, because they're both wonderful groups of children's orthopedic surgeons. But being able to influence those organizations seemed a way to impact care the way I wanted to. As time went on, leadership opportunities come up and you begin to say, well, I can't just do research. I need to go out and actually try and affect change. So having a leadership opportunity at a place like SickKids gives you the opportunity to affect change, because you have a more direct role. And what I appreciated as Surgeon in Chief and Chief of Perioperative Services at SickKids, that access was a major issue. Worldwide, there's a focus on adults. There'd been very little, almost no attention paid to children. In fact, many people think children get a free ride. And it was very clear to me that SickKids and most children's hospitals, at least in Canada, but I think it's probably true worldwide, have similar issues. So it became, we need to highlight that. And so therefore we developed measures in which we said, what is a reasonable time in which to have a children's operation? So we developed what we called access targets for 860 diagnoses. And then we went across Canada and measured the weights in 200,000 children. Turns out that children weigh just as much as adults do. And that was a very important step forward in advocating to the government. And it served as a useful tool. So at SickKids, we were able to triage patients. And when I started, we had 50% of children who exceeded a reasonably acceptable wait time, and by the time I left SickKids, it was down under 10%. So these are the kinds of things you can do if you have talented people you work with, where you lay out a research agenda, but always with the idea how you're going to implement it. So that was the framework in which we operated, and it was a very gratifying thing to see, because we did some research to show that if children wait, it's not good for them. Mm.
And obviously this work that you did was very well received. I mean, we were honoured with the Order of Canada, and I'm sure this was a large part of it, and will be a very big part of your legacy. It's also, it would be remiss of me not to mention that I've recently read a book called Healing Children by Kurt Newman from the National Children's Hospital in DC, and he approaches this exact same thing about how over his long career he has...
Okay, well, you'll send me the link and I'll read it.
I'll send you a copy of the book instead.
Okay.
Let's go on to obviously we went back to evidence-based medicine, and you wrote a textbook on it. You know, you've had over 250 articles, 20,000 plus citations, so really heavily invested in this. Do you feel evidence-based medicine hinders innovation and development technologies in orthopedics or in the medical field?
Sure. So this has been something that is a potential risk. So evidence-based medicine is about doing the best thing for the patients in a consistent fashion. And it implies that there is an answer. And obviously, there are some answers, but there's not a single answer. And where do the new answers come from? Well, they have to come from innovation. The problem that I identified is we have too many innovators. In fact, just about every surgeon you talk to thinks that they are innovative, and many of them are. But that's led to the uncontrolled introduction of just about everything in orthopedics. So you have a great group at Oxford looking at the way surgical innovations should be entered into the clinical arena. I thought of this as an innovation cycle. What basically happens is people come up with a proof of concept, and it goes right from proof of concept to treatment. And there are many more steps that need to be in between. And my basic view is innovation should be under controlled circumstances in very few places. And we've got great academic centers, you know, Great Ormond Street, Boston Children's, Sick Kids, San Diego. That's where innovation should be centered. You can't have everyone innovating, otherwise it's chaos. So it's a risk, but you need to balance that risk and understand there's a role for innovation, but also for the majority of care, there needs to be standardization.
Mm. And as you said, you know, focusing not only innovation, but when, let's say, we come down to publication, you were one of the inaugural editors of JBJS evidence section. Why did you think it was important for a journal to have an evidence-based section? And what was your role in helping develop that and maintaining it to this day?
So as I, probably 8 to 10 years into my practice, my clinical research career, I recognized simply publishing was not going to have the impact that I was necessary. So therefore, you need to have different strategies. So we developed a clinical trials curriculum with the American Orthopedic Association and the AOS, believing that training residents and junior faculty. So there's a curriculum, which is still available on the AO website, which tells trainers how to train residents and fellows. I thought it was important we had an evidence-based book. So we developed evidence-based orthopedics, and it was based around 100 clinical questions that would confront an orthopedic surgeon perhaps once a year, believing that textbooks should be written using evidence-based guidelines. Through professional associations, clinical trials committee. So I was the inaugural chair of the clinical trials committee of the Pediatric Orthopedic Society. I was involved in the outcomes committee at the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery. And then through lectures and writing in the journal was, again, not having the impact. So I thought journals, orthopedic journals, need to be influenced. And how do you do that? Well, we came up with two things. I had the privilege of working with Jim Heckman, and then later with Mark Swinkowski. Vern Tolo was in between there. Great editors of JBJS who are open to changing the way orthopedic journals popularized the concept of evidence-based medicine. So the first was to create the evidence-based medicine section, and that was to alert orthopedic surgeons both to the presence of evidence outside of JBJS, but also to show them that randomized clinical trials in orthopedic surgery could exist. And then we introduced the levels of evidence, and that came from Gordon Guyatt, ultimately the Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine, but we adapted it so it was accessible for orthopedic surgeons. And every abstract had a levels of evidence rating. So I would have reviewed, I think I ended up, don't mean to exaggerate, but I think it was like thousands and thousands of articles which I rated, and that allowed orthopedic surgeons to understand that there was different levels. It's obviously highly simplistic. Not every level one evidence is better than every two level evidence, but it was accessible, and that has been adopted by pretty much every orthopedic journal other than in the UK, which has shown some resistance to my disappointment, but there you go.
What's your opinion on these Delphi consensus exercises that are now being conducted? Are they useful? And do you think we should be using them to help? Because at the end of the day, it is a consensus. It doesn't maybe always answer the real nail on the head question. But what's your opinion about that?
It's useful to assemble opinions among some really smart people through a explicit process. But as you said, it's just people's opinions. So it's better than my opinion or your opinion in that it's a consensus, but it's only a group of opinions. And that's part of the difficulty, is you get a different Delphi group together and you come up with a different set of recommendations. So when you're trying to prioritize what you might study, such as the James Lind, I think it's a very useful process. But if you're trying to land on what's the best treatment, it's just a group of pretty smart people who come up with something, but it's just their opinion. It has to be based on science. Opinions are just, they're interesting, but they're not the way to land on the best treatment for patients.
And after all these years, what do you feel still are, let's say, the top three questions that you feel need answering in pediatric orthopedics through better formal evidence-based research?
So I would answer that not in terms of simple questions, but for example, the cerebral palsy group. That's a hugely complex topic. How do we decide what is the best for this group of patients who are often physically limited in what they can do, and the implications of surgery, the stakes are pretty high in that they have high complication rates, pain, perhaps worsening. So that's a group that I think will really benefit from evidence-based practice, because I don't think we know virtually anything for sure that we're helping these children in the long term. And they already have other health issues in orthopedics. I really worry that we're not helping them. But if we are, then we need to know that and we need to do more of it. So that would be one large group of things that I think needs to be sorted out. And I guess the other thing is our hip conditions, which really haven't changed much. You talked about Dan Perry and his work on leg prothese. I don't think that field has moved hardly at all since I was a resident. That's a bit of an overgeneralization, but when you really think about the number of children, some who get surgery, some who don't get surgery, the kinds of surgery that's done, that's an area where we really need to have better answers. So.
And Dan says he's going to retire when he's able to answer that question. So I'm sure there's a few decades worth of work left in him to answer that. Obviously, you had this long career at SickKids, and then I believe you went across the University of Oxford as a professor. What were you doing there with them?
So I was shifting my focus from doing research to implementation science. So it was an opportunity to both immerse myself and begin to think about how we might change orthopedic practice. The UK, through the NHS, which is this admirable national organization, looked to me at a system level doing the kinds of things that I thought needed to be done. The UK, I think, is surging ahead in evidence-based practice through the work of Dan and Matt Costa and others. The number of trials going on in the UK is inspiring. Oxford, obviously, a center of evidence-based medicine. Andy Carr is a world leader in research. It was probably the best musculoskeletal research center in the world. So to have an affiliation with that was a really exciting opportunity. So I thought perhaps that might be a vehicle that we could begin to think about tackling practice at a national level. It looked to me to be the best positioned place in the world. I spent 2.5 years there. I learned an enormous amount. I came away and learned that the NHS is fabulous, but the engagement of clinicians at the coalface, as David Sackett used to say, is lacking just like it is in Canada. And that's an impediment. You have this great national health service, but really when it comes to the change management and engaging patients at the ground level, it lacks.
And you know, University of Oxford is linked to some African institutions as well. They have a big orthopedic link. Do you think that research done in the developed world should be applied to the developing world? And how best can they work together to sort of tackle more local and national issues there?
You know, it's a complex question of which I think I only have opinions. This is an area which I don't want to espouse some kind of expertise. There is such a burden of musculoskeletal disease, trauma, surgical disease worldwide, but it's an area where there could be a huge impact that should be performed and led by researchers in the area. So how you do that, how you build that capacity, but absolutely we can learn from everyone. And I suspect there'll be innovations, treatment advances, which will come from those countries, which we would be crazy not to learn from.
And finally, now you're at the Ontario Medical Association, you're Chief of Health Policy, Economics and Research. What does your current role entail here?
So I, again, have the privilege of working with about 45 very talented people. And what's always driven me is to have an impact. So I looked after thousands of patients, but they were one at a time. I got involved in evidence-based medicine and research because I thought that would be a way to impact the field, and you get so far. What I'm interested in now is healthcare transformation. Ontario is a single payer where they're engaged in a ambitious healthcare transformation. Physicians are absolutely essential to that. And the OMA is the vehicle and the platform by which we can bring those views and use that leverage to actually change a healthcare system. And that's what this opportunity provides. So we'll see what I can accomplish in a few years.
Fantastic. Well, look, Professor Wright, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. And I'll be sure to send you a copy of that book by Kurt Newman.
Excellent. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure. You.